Thank you very much. To Frida and the entire team for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be able to, you know, have a chat with comrades. I have been traveling in West Africa doing some archival work, and thanks to the reality of global inequality, I find myself in a place with really poor internet connection. So I will try and see if you can hear me, but for now I will just switch off my video just to preserve the bandwidth. So my presentation is titled Colonial Statecraft, Xenophobia, and Solidarity in Africa. Now, the presentation will be divided into, you know, three broad parts. So I will firstly talk briefly about what colonialism meant for accumulation, but also for identity formation in Africa. I will then talk about how that gave rise to a very narrow understanding of belonging, which privileges autochthonity and therefore saw people who were new into societies as others to be discriminated against. I would then finally zoom into South Africa. In the introduction, it was said that I work in South Africa. I work at the University of Cape Town in Africa. I will look at some work that we've been doing with comrades around the question of access to housing, access to education, access to healthcare, in notions of belonging, and therefore an anti-xenophobia politics. The question that I end up with, and I hope that will generate some discussion, is whether such broad understanding of belonging that is rooted in material condition could lead to a different kind of popular politics, which is class-based. So let's begin. You see, in the 1970s, there was a major debate across radical African campuses, like at the University of Dar es Salaam, University of Ibadan in Nigeria, University of Ahmadu Bello, also in Nigeria, about the character of imperialism and colonialism in Africa. Now, one take assumes that colonialism was essentially market domination, that the main impetus for colonialism was economic exploitation, and any notion of extra economic dispossession or exploitation was secondary to the colonial imperative. So meaning, colonialism simply was an attempt to look for space in order to obtain cheap raw materials, in order to create market for finished goods, in order to obtain cheap labor. And so any other thing was unimportant to this primary imperative, which is economic. Colonialism was also a process of identity formation. Colonialism was an attempt to define who people were in order to govern them. Now, a major protagonist in this debate is a scholar called Mahmoud Mamdani, from Uganda, in Makerere University, but also in Columbia and New York. The first proposition of colonialism essentially as market domination was put forward by people like Walter Rodney, and I'm sure most of the people in the webinar know Walter Rodney. Now, this understanding of colonialism gave rise to what I think are, in a sense, two binary understandings. So one which really believes that in order to understand colonialism, one has to focus on the economic imperative. And another which says that colonialism was a racist, white supremacist project, and what it seeks to do is to dominate. Now, that was the polarizing camps. Now, in my understanding of this debate and how I relate to it in my political work, but also in my intellectual work, is really to refuse to see colonialism as something whose major imperative was either economic or identity formation, but to think of colonialism as a process of market domination which requires extra economic factors in order to function. And this is what I mean. So if you take the part of Africa that I come from West Africa, I come from Ghana. In Ghana, the British, just like in other colonies that the British ruled, had a three-tier form of defining belonging. You could either be a native, meaning you're from a British colony, if you're from Ghana. You could also be an alien, meaning you're from, let's say, Burkina Faso or Cote d'Ivoire or Senegal. And you could be a citizen of the colony. So you're from mainland Britain, or you happen to be from one of the colonies in the Caribbean, right? And you, in a sense, if you take the French model, you are an évolué. You have a certain level of education, and so you acquire a status above the native and above the alien. But among the natives, you also have a situation in which one part of the country, if you think of Ghana, we have a broad division between northern Ghana and southern Ghana. Northern Ghana served as a reservoir for the provision of labor to the mines and the plantations of southern Ghana. What that did was to create a political community in which some people's function was essentially the provision of labor, while a new emergent, you wouldn't call them bourgeois, but a certain limited level of property class began to emerge. And then you see a fusion between geography and class, because one part of the country provides labor to plantations and mines in another part of the country. And those who were linked to the aristocracy, you know, children of the chiefs, happen to have stakes in these mines and these farms. And so being a native from the south equals, in the popular imagination, a certain level of privilege relative to being a native from the north. Now, another example is Southern Africa, and in particular, South Africa. As I'm sure you are all aware, you know, South Africa is one of, you know, the last colonies, really. Some in South Africa will still tell you it is a colony, especially those in Cape Town. They call it the Republic of Cape Town, the colony of Cape Town. In Cape Town and in other parts of South Africa, what happened was a situation in which you have a tree tier. You have whites at the top, you have Indians, you have a group called quote-unquote colored, and then you have Africans. Now, among Africans, because people have different ethnicities, you would have somebody who is Zulu, another person is Xhosa, another person is Pedi, another person is Sesotho. What colonialism did in this constellation is to create a situation whereby identity was linked to place, meaning if you were Zulu, you are seen as having something called a natural homeland, and your natural homeland is KwaZulu-Natal. And I will give an example with Germany to illustrate the case. So if somebody is, you know, from Bavaria, right? Under this framework, you are seen as naturally belonging to the place around, I don't know, Omersbach, whatever little huts and villages in Bavaria. If the person moves down towards Frankfurt, they are seen to have crossed their natural habitat. The assumption is that Africans operate in natural homelands. Their leadership, their form of economic organization is supposed to take place within the confines of the natural homeland. If somebody were to leave the natural homeland, then they have disrupted the natural equilibrium of African social existence. That was the colonial theory. This colonial theory has two sources. One, of course, is Henry Maine, you know, the idea of indirect rule. But the other, you know, is the whole enterprise called colonial anthropology, you know, that was trying to understand the way of thinking of the backward people. And Africans, in a sense, represented that backwardness. But what has this got to do with accumulation? If you have people divided into natural homeland based on the idea that these people live their lives in their natural homelands, it means you can easily control labor from KwaZulu-Natal to the mines around Johannesburg. You can easily get Xhosa peasants to leave, because people who were forced to leave their farms through hard tax, to leave their farms and go and work in the plantations of the Eastern Cape. But in the process, you are also constructing identity, okay? Because if a person is from KwaZulu-Natal, and historically they became Zulu through a process of migration, because, you know, society really becomes what it is as a result of mobility. But here you freeze this process of social formation and you root people in a place and say, no, this is your homeland, you are not allowed to leave. Over time, what you do is you create a particular consciousness, a consciousness which is rooted in place, and a consciousness which creates the situation in which you can either be this or that, you cannot be this and that. The result of that was the cultivation of ethnic and quote-unquote tribal sentiment and the connection between that and economic activity, such that you begin to have a caste or a class of people who are from a particular ethnic identity, but those people would happen to be the ones who maybe collect refuse, or they would happen to be the ones who work on plantations or on mines, right? Now, unfortunately, in the African anti-colonial movement, the aspects of a more broad-based working class politics was often marginalized at the expense of nation building and a multi-class alliance. So the politics of class collaboration often took precedence over a genuine working class alternative, which roots politics and a vision of alternative in the current reality and the aspiration of ordinary people. So that often, instead of undoing the elements of these colonial statecraft of combining ethnicity and economic activity, political authorities that became authorities after that, the colonial struggle, actually cemented these differences. Why? Because in many instances, it provided political basis. People mobilized on the basis of ethnic identities that had been cultivated by colonial statecraft. And here I just want to spend 2 minutes talking about the reality of identity formation historically in Africa. And one can use the same formula to think of Europe or any other parts of the world. You see, African societies are often made up of mobile groups. In West Africa, we call them Fulani. In East Africa, the Maasai will represent that. So the idea of nomadic livelihood is very central to identity formation, that people move from one place to another in search of livelihoods, and this is how identities are formed. So I'm in West Africa at the moment, and you meet somebody living in Accra. His name is Muhammadu Accra or Habibu Takoradi. But originally, that person is from Burkina Faso or they are from Northern Nigeria. People's sense of identity is often tied to where they live, not where they come from. And this is really important, because in many parts of the African continent, the idea of a Bintu, the notion that a person becomes fully human when they discover the world, is very central to how people think of being human. So among the Hausas of West Africa, there is a category of social ordering called Yao and Dendi. Yao and Dendi simply means a person who is born in Frankfurt will be considered a fish that is trapped in a pond if they haven't been to Berlin, if they haven't been to Leipzig, if they haven't been to London. So the idea is that a human being has to move beyond where they're born because the world is supposed to be a place to explore. So that means identity can also not be fixed. It has to be in flux. But colonialism attempted to undo this by fixing identity and creating notions of difference, which is eternal, which is unchanging. Many after colonialism took on board this idea and therefore assumed that ethnicity or quote-unquote tribe is something which is inherent to how people live their lives. But what actually that did is that it cemented colonial statecraft by creating states where citizenship was often linked to ethnic identity and not to one's commitment to a place or to residency. While that was what existed in the pre-colonial setting, the residency and livelihood was linked to identity and not any notion of originality. Because you see, and I think maybe let me...
Faisal, we don't hear you anymore.
The notion of colonial statecraft, because it sought to undo any process of the meeting of people, which would effectively lead to people realizing what they share in common. But in spite of that, this meeting of people happened, because colonial economies were often linked to raw materials, and these raw materials would be taken from a rural area to the port to Europe. And if you think of colonial infrastructure in Africa, it is often one railway from where you can find rubber, gold, cocoa, or timber to the port and to London or to France, right? So basically, the export-oriented nature of colonial economy meant that you have a one-directional way through the economic function. That also meant that working class people happen to group around these major areas, whether it's ports or mines or plantations. Because labor is required, you had to bring people from different so-called homelands. As people came to the homelands, they began to see actually that they are workers, they are underpaid, many of them are not even paid, they live in very poor accommodation, have very little access to healthcare. And so ideas of popular politics, class consciousness organically emerges out of this process of bringing people together in order to exploit them. Now that is important, because what that did was to question the logic of statecraft, of divide and rule, because people now begin to see it doesn't matter whether you are Ashanti or Hausa, you are underpaid, you are a working class native, you see? And so it didn't take any organizer versed in political theory to educate some of these workers, but their everyday realities educated them. And so the docks, the farms, the plantations were important sites of concrete political education arising out of the contradiction of colonial statecraft. Now, I'll just spend some time trying to take this framework to South Africa, you know, because we're talking about xenophobia and solidarity, and see how this plays out. As everybody here is aware, South Africa is the most unequal society in the world in terms of income. Okay? If you go to Cape Town, where I work, you would see a place that looks like, you know, some of the castles in Bayern where the old aristocracy live. But also you where you wonder, how does a human being live in this place? And the distance could be about 300 meters, right? So unbelievable poverty and incredible extravagance living side by side. This history produces a particular violent relationship between working class locals and foreigners. Because apartheid, in a sense, created and sustained the notion that South Africa was only geographically in Africa. But culturally, intellectually, South Africa is, you know, next to Frankfurt or next to London. And so this idea was inculcated in ordinary people. And the post-apartheid state, you know, took a very exclusivist understanding of citizenship. We saw citizenship as something that was somehow in people's veins and something that was unchanging. And the reality of mass unemployment meant that whenever working class people rise up for housing, for education, what they see next to them is a Somali immigrant who left Somalia as a result of the imperialist war that completely destroyed that country. They see that person as the reason why they're unemployed, because often in local government elections, politicians say, you know, we are going to take spaza shops are kiosks. We're going to take all these spaza shops that all the Somalis and all these Nigerians are running, and we're going to give it to you, okay? So in a sense, you have a deflection of the contradiction, which is the reality of inherited apartheid inequality, massive corruption, which is linked to the activities of transnational corporations and the new elite led by the ANC, and the problem now becomes, you know, upward. And this means that often working class people are placed in a situation in which they have to fight each other. They have to fight each other for jobs, they have to fight each other for housing. And so what we've done over the past few years with some comrades is to try and see how working with poor and working class people to get housing, for healthcare, for education, we can also raise the question of migrancy and fuse them together. To say, what is it that brought the Somali tax shop operator to a township? What is the reality of Somalia? What is the nature of asset and income distribution in Somalia? What is the nature of poverty in Somalia? And if we compare that to the situation in South Africa, where are we going to find the equivalent of the poor in Somalia? We're going to find that equivalent in the township. And what about the elites in Somalia? What is their connection with the elites in South Africa? Because as you all know, South Africa is a dominant economic force in Africa. And many of the rich in South Africa actually have investment in other parts of Africa. So if you go to any major African city today, you are likely to see ShopRite. You're likely to see Game. ShopRite is your Lidl or let's say it's your Aldi, for example, right? Now, ShopRite has effectively crowded out many small-scale trade sellers of tomatoes, of onions on the street. People subsist by selling basic food items. ShopRite provides these things through, you know, its massive economies of scale and therefore crowds out these small-scale traders. And so what we try to do is to create a condition that begins the process of a conversation between these ordinary people. And in one township where we operate, I mean, it's called Langa, it's just in the outskirts of Cape Town, it's next to the Cape Town Airport. It's one of the only townships where over the past 5-6 years, there hasn't been any outbreak of xenophobic violence. And it is because street councils, organizations of people who are living with HIV, groupings of women in particular, old women who happen to be the backbone of many of these societies, you know, are very active in raising some of these questions about the commonalities of the struggles of working people, whether they are foreigners or they are locals. This therefore raises, I think, an important question about what an anti-imperialist politics would look like today. And for us, operating from Cape Town, which we think some of the lessons could be applicable across other parts of the world where comrades work, is that the notion of the public sphere, given the reality of mobility, cannot be understood as one which is settled. That immigrants are central to the public sphere, that any politics, any working class politics, which begins from a national frame and defines the working class strictly from a national frame, completely buys into an imperialist world out. The working class, unfortunately, historically, has often been co-opted into imperialist projects. So at a particular moment, the working class movement in South Africa had a slogan. And the slogan, the first part of the slogan is quite progressive, and I'm sure we all like it. And it says, working class of the world unites. I'm sure we all agree. But what comes after it, it says, for a white South Africa. The working class of the world unite for a white South Africa, right? And so what here we're trying to say is that given the deep connection between imperialism, between colonialism and contemporary capitalism, that for us to think of a new politics, a new emancipatory politics, we have to begin by questioning the makeup of the nation. We have to realize that these nation states were product of processes of accumulation. And so the identities that they contain are not natural. They are very purposes. In Cape Town, we've tried by saying that if we want to think about who lives in the community and what do they need, whether they are from Eastern Cape or they are from Mozambique, whether they are from Johannesburg or they are from Morocco, that what matters is the fact that these are ordinary working class people who have needs. And these needs have to be met by a collective organization. And if a division along national identity is allowed to hold sway, then imperialism effectively takes sway. So I will stop here because my idea is this should be more of a conversation than me just talking. I'm happy to answer questions in English or German or comments. And so thank you very much.